each trademark owner has to make an assessment of what their IP portfolio, their protection is, and then how it might be endangered along the way, and then the methods available to try to control it.
You are listening to Intangiblia, the podcast of intangible law, plain talk about intellectual property. Please welcome your host, Leticia Caminero.
Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of the third season. Since this is the last episode of the season, we have a very special treat. We have not one or two guests, and we're going to talk about trademark, but trademark in a very comprehensive way. We're going to talk about how to protect the brand in the gray markets and in counterfeiting scenarios, and we're going to talk about also how to bust the bootleg. Let's welcome our guests.
I'm Peter Honecker. I'm Canadian. I was born and raised actually in Europe and Slovakia. Currently living in Singapore. I've been around for more than 30 years in the high-tech world, working for large companies, including Fitbit, BlackBerry, SunPower, Nortel Networks, and so on. Currently, I'm the founder and CEO of Five Ventures with the focus on intellectual property strategy, commercialization protection, as well as brand protection and risk management, including supply chain security. How I came across with the counterfeiting was actually my MBA project that we chose was around counterfeiting at the time. It was around 2000. We went to China, did the MBA trip, and we were purchasing counterfeit goods and make the final presentation and thesis on the counterfeiting. And surely enough, 5 years later, I was asked to take on the intellectual property protection at Nortel, starting with the gray market and counterfeiting. And that's pretty much it. Rest of the history. Tony, over to you.
Very good. I'm Tony Keats. I'm practicing law in Los Angeles, California, at the law firm of Keats Gadian. And I've been an intellectual property lawyer for too long, over 35 years. And my practice has focused on developing IP protection programs, enforcement, litigation of rights, and particularly in the anti-counterfeiting and anti-piracy area. After my undergraduate degrees and a master's degree from Brown University, I joined a multinational food and beverage company called Hubline and became a brand manager for Inglenook Wines of Napa. And that gave me the opportunity to start getting engaged with branding and consumer products. And I went to law school in San Francisco. And once I got out of law school, my very first job was working for the president of the International Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition, which was then headquartered in San Francisco, now in Washington, D.C. And I became sort of the associate to support the first criminal investigations and prosecutions under the 1984 Anti-Counterfeiting Act in the U.S., which ended up in a prosecution of someone counterfeiting personal care products. Now I spend much of my time engaged with clients in the entertainment industry, fashion, and luxury goods on international, sort of on an international scope. So that's a brief background into what I do.
You also had a question, what made us to write a book? Yeah, 2010, I came over the opportunity to write something with lawyers from Chicago, which ended up not going forward, but because we already had an agreement with Law Journal Press, I pressed forward, and Tony came on the board, so he wrote the thesis for Law Journal Press, and which was published in 2013. We did about 3 years of updates every year. We weren't too happy about it because it's overpriced for a majority of the public. The uniqueness of our book actually is that it's geared toward executives, not just law practitioners. And we try to convince the Law Journal Press to publish it as a normal book, either paperback or electronic. And then we got our copyrights back, and we're looking for a publisher, and we finally settled. And as you know, the volume one was already published, and the volume two should be on shelves, I think, early in May, if not late April. So there you go.
Great. So you both have quite diverse and interesting backgrounds. So how did you meet?
I think we go back more than 10 years, right?
Yes.
I think we met first time when I was working at Dolby Laboratories. And we had a common friends, and, we met and we clicked. And then we met after that a few times at CES, for example, right? And we kind of got conversation going. And I don't know, Tony, you want to add anything?
So you have a very interesting background. You met each other through the profession, and you wrote a book together, well, two books together. And now let's talk a bit more about the content of both of the books. What is the gray market, and how can we define it? Is it different from the black market? And is it something that is 100% illegal? It's somewhat illegal. It's illegal accordingly. It's something that is not necessarily counter to the trademark rights. Can you tell us a bit more about what is the gray market?
Tony, I'll take this one, and I'll let you talk more about the next topics, and which are a little bit geared more towards the legal. So let's just define the gray market. So what the gray market is, or is also referred as apparel imports, is basically genuine products with legitimate authorized trademarks that are intended for sales to specific markets and used in those markets, but which are then imported and sold in other markets, which they have not been authorized for without the consent of the trademark owner or its authorized distributors, okay? So but the gray market typically arises under three ownership arrangements. So let me just use the U.S. market example, okay? So the three ownership arrangements are generally: one is a domestic company not related to foreign trademark owner that purchases the exclusive rights to the foreign trademarks in the United States. Second is the domestic company, which is controlled by the foreign trademark owner, i.e. subsidiary, for example, and has an exclusive right to foreign trademarks in the United States. Or the third example is, or third case is, domestic owner of a U.S. trademark gives a foreign company the right to use a mark outside of the United States. So it's each of these three situations, goods with legitimate trademarks are similar to the domestic goods, but not intended for sales in the U.S. And therefore, they wind up being in direct competition to those that are authorized to sell in the US market, right? So unlike counterfeit goods, which contain unauthorized copies of the marks, gray market is are goods that are identical to the US cousins and may be lawfully sold in the United States. The only time where they're against the lawful sale are when they're materially different from their from the originals. This is basically the summary of the gray market.
So the gray market is, I found, for example, I go on a trip to another country. I purchase the item that is legally sold there. I purchase, like, say, a dozen, and I take it back to the U.S. and I sell it there without the authorization of the trademark holder.
The goods are sold first time, there's really nothing preventing you from doing so. However, if you make a business out of it and you import it against the authorization in the large quantities, that's where it becomes a problem, right? Because you're not really, as a business, you're not authorized to transact in, with those, in those goods in that specific market.
So what is the first sale doctrine? Is the right that I have to sell whatever I bought legally? Or can you explain that a bit further?
The first sale doctrine comes up more in the copyright context, but basically it's once you purchase a good from a vendor, a manufacturer, an authorized manufacturer, let's say, they no longer control. They sort of, their rights are exhausted in terms of, you know, being able to control how it's sold again, you know, a second time, or if you give it to someone as a gift. But it's a, it's a, it's considered, you know, a product that's subject to the first sale rights. And oftentimes that issue still gets contested, because whether it's applicable or not in the context of gray market and counterfeit goods. Sometimes something is considered not a counterfeit because it's got protection, you know, under first sale, or it's not, usually in the copyright context, it's not a pirated good because it's still, there's still rights of the creator that pertain to that good.
Generally challenge with the gray market, right? So unless the goods are materially different, if there's a material difference in the goods between those two specific markets, for example, where you bought it and when you bring it in, then it's really difficult to enforce legally. And this is why a lot of manufacturers actually differentiate their goods. Maybe just talking about the decals and labels and just description and the warnings that the goods are only intended for sale in specific territory. Therefore, when they're imported and general consumers buy this, and there's all these warnings and different language labels, or there may be something on a product that makes a difference. I'll give you an example of the Omega watch that was sold in Costco that was imported from European market to US, mm-hmm. which had a completely different print and on the back of the watches. So there's a potential to enforce that.
Tell us about this Omega watch story.
Oh, you can read our book.
I guess a quick summary.
I think it was successfully contested, right, Tony, if I recall that. We have a number of cases, but generally what Omega did was, when you have a plate on the back of the watch, there was a different logo and I think different mark used in the back, which allowed them then successfully contest the import to the United States without their consent. And I think the Costco had to pay the penalties and all that.
One of the interesting aspects of this is for the companies, the brand holders, in that some will have, as Peter pointed out, many variations on a product, like a toothpaste, a famous toothpaste, will have different languages, different use instructions. Also, companies that try to maintain pricing consistent around the world, that seems to, you know, make a difference in terms of whether people are going to violate that pricing structure. And Peter can talk a lot about this. That gets into the gray market issues as well. Those companies that do a lot of different pricing and lots of different labeling, as you can imagine, these global, you know, personal care products or pharmaceuticals, they have the biggest gray market problems because the products just get distributed through so many different avenues into various countries. You know, part of, you try to control it to the extent you can as a brand holder, but it's very difficult.
Well, even the simplistic example of the, let's say, semiconductor industry, right? So you have consumers that, and customers or distributors that buy bulk volume, and some of them buy in a bulk volume, therefore get a higher discount, and then only use a specific portion of it and dump the rest. One reason is to obtain the high discount, and some of them also sell it at the profit and pocket the difference. So this is why the green market is basically happening. And as Tony mentioned, in some markets, and this is very typical for a lot of goods, is not everybody can price their product like Apple does, which is the same price all around the world. A lot of companies choose to recognize the purchase power. So, if you go to developing countries, the products obviously, need to be priced in the lesser to allow consumers to buy it. Otherwise, they won't be able to buy it. Now, it's a little bit different for luxury goods, Tony, right? Yes. They try to maintain the same level and say, if you can't afford us, we don't want you. But when you're talking about general consumer products, companies live on the volume sales, and therefore they need to be sensitive to the pricing to different markets. And this is one of the major reasons for gray market is they basically live out of the arbitrage. So as long as the price differential between, and I'll give you examples, Levi's jeans are way more expensive in Europe than they are in the U.S. So if the price differential is high enough for them to buy a bulk in Europe and bring it to U.S. and sell it to U.S. and make money out of it, then they'll do it.
How it can affect the trademark then? What is the consequence of the trademark, the gray market? I am a trademark holder. Yeah. Why would I want to avoid the gray market? Because I lose control over my goods, because it's a deterrent to my trademark, or is there a moment where a gray market could be beneficial to a trademark holder?
Number of reasons. I would say I'll be in devil advocate and say, when you're a company that tries to enter new markets, you may ride a gray market for a little while until it becomes a pain in the butt, because it's sort of like letting you to get part of the market. No. But once you're a serious player in that market, you want to, first of all, protect your margins. I mean, let's be honest, the marketing, product development costs money, right? So you don't want these guys just a free ride on your trademark and make money out of it where you're basically losing the money. Second thing is, there is a support infrastructure that goes to every market to support your product, especially when you're talking the high tech, especially when you talk about something that is, if it's not handled properly, and we can, gray market often can go and evolve into the black market, which means some product can start as a gray market. Let's say pharmaceuticals, right? They imported the country without consent of the brand owner, but then they may be expired, and these guys are going to relabel it, change the expiry date, and sell it, which is becoming illegal and quite puts consumers in a danger. So it's going back to technical support. You need the technical support. People that buy gray market product expect the support, expect the call centers, expect that. And if that infrastructure is not in place, because you're not supposed to be there in the first place, right? That's additional cost to you and impacts your reputational reputation. It's a high reputational risk for the company to have a gray market goods, and especially in the market that they're really not set up to do.
There are virtually no benefits apart from may have some brand recognition at the beginning, may help you spread your product around the market, but in the end, it does affect your trademark, and it can affect your reputation and your standing in the market that you're looking to succeed in.
Consumers, you said there's no benefit. Consumers believe there's a benefit because they're getting products at lower prices. And they're quote authorized products, so they're not fake. You know, they're not counterfeit to the extent that you know you're dealing with a counterfeit unauthorized product. However, you know, that leads to sort of a belief among consumers that you buy these products through let's say, authorized distribution networks, it's safe. You know, the products you're buying are safe. And that's a huge problem because I think consumers get used to buying through non-authorized outlets, outlets that don't have the expertise to recommend a certain product to you. And that sort of strengthens the counterfeiting, you know, appeal of counterfeits.
In addition to it, a lot of them offer a warranty that is an extent to a normal manufacturer warranty. Let's say for some type of products, it's 90 days or 1 year, where these gray marketers offering 2 years, but they have no infrastructure to do that. And again, that impacts you as a brand owner from a reputational point of view. Although the goods are genuine, although they may be in a good shape and they work properly, but you know, you still need to support it. And that's actually going back to the material difference where gray marketers offering warranty that is outside the regular brand owner warranty is actually a material difference that can be recognized in courts.
Okay. Yeah, of course. Because for example, if I buy an item, let's say a bag, and I know that the brand has the reputation that if there's something wrong with the bag, you can take it back to them and they will fix it right away, or they will even exchange it to a new bag if there's something that they cannot fix in the one that you purchase. But if you buy on the gray market and then you try to go to the official channel, you're not going to be able to have that service. And then you're going to think it's the brand that has the problem, but it's not exactly that. It's because you didn't do it the right way at the beginning. So you cannot expect to have the benefits if you did not do it through the official channel.
Correct. Although some of them may provide replacements, but they generally use the secondary goods, which are used or refurbished, which again, you know, add additional risk to the reputation and consumers might not be happy with the product. So,
yeah, makes sense. So, I would like to move on to counterfeiting. So can you define what it is and which forms we can find it in the market? You can use any cases or examples that you think.
Counterfeits are generally in the four kind of types. So one is the unauthorized production of the branded goods. The example of that, somebody's making Louis Vuitton bags, right? Which bears the trademarks. It's not genuine, but it makes it look alike, and it also bears the trademarks. Second form is the relabeling, repackaging, or both, of the products that would then falsely appear to be branded products, which they are not. When the original products are used obsolete could be quality rejects, they're still genuine products, but they're lower quality and still bear trademarks, so that presents a potential risk to consumers. And I think example, you can imagine any example. So any other consumer goods or goods that are failing past the quality test and are supposed to be maybe destroyed, but somehow leaked to the market and somebody just selling it as a brand new goods. Which is a shady area because that can come as can be recognized as a consumer fraud, in which case it's all move into the area of the black market and counterfeiting. But there are still genuine goods. They're just anytime you add any fraud or theft, because a lot of these quality rejects may be just leaked from a factory by theft. So then you entering between from gray market, you enter into the black market. Third type is combination of parts. So when somebody's manufacturing a product without authorization, using a trademark, which they are not authorized to use, and they combine genuine parts with the counterfeit parts or unauthorized parts. And this basically more applicable to high tech or any machinery, as basically referred to as a Frankenstein engineering. And the fourth type is somebody that has unauthorized production of the branded goods, but they're actually don't bear the trademark. So let's say somebody's making a Rolex watch, but don't brand it as a Rolex, but they're exactly look alike. And you know, you've seen the cases where you go to Chinese stores, you know, in the silk market, whatever, and you buy Rolex, R-O-L-A-X, you know, and they're exactly look alike. So those are kind of hard to enforce. And it's basically in stolen intellectual property. So let's say somebody steals the technology, reverse engineers something, makes it exact same lookalike copy and function. And some of them are actually pretty good quality as well. I've seen an example of those, but they don't use a trademark. This what makes it for brand owners to be a little bit more difficult to enforce, because there's no trademark. You cannot really enforce it through the trademark. There are other avenues, which we also mentioned in the book, is a International Trade Commission, ITC exclusion orders.
Yeah.
So you can file for exclusion order charging with the importers that are importing goods that are infringing on your intellectual property, and does not have to be necessarily trademarks. Could be patents, which are kind of hard to enforce. I'll give you an example. Philips in, 80s, writable CDs, they had a huge problem with a Chinese unauthorized CDs coming back to US and basically flooding the market. And because they didn't bear any trademarks, they couldn't really enforce it through the customs as an import. So they did file ITC exclusion order for this particular type of goods. And basically going from, 80% of the counterfeit goods on the market, they reduced it and within a year to 20%. So there are different avenues to do so, but again, all of these are a little bit more complicated, and they also cost a lot of money. I think, to file any large ITC exclusion order can come in order of $1 million, $2 million, and it takes about 2 years, right? So it's quite expensive. But again, you have to make as a brand owner decision, what is it that you try to achieve? So those are basically the four types of counterfeits. And of course, there's, as I mentioned, there are the ones that the type two are the leak factory manufacturing overruns, which are basically made as the same factory as the genuine goods, but they run more copies or more products than they are authorized to do so, and they sell them as their own brand or as a brand owner trademarks as well. So these are the examples.
Peter, on just that example, I testified in a case as an expert in a case where it was a perfume case in Europe, and the perfume manufacturer had a contract with the glass bottle maker that the irregular bottles that didn't meet their standards were supposed to be destroyed. And rather than, and the glass manufacturer contracted with a third party for the destruction. What happened is the bottles went to the destruction contractor, and they did a deal with a counterfeiter, and the counterfeiter got the irregular bottles. This is not unusual, and refilled them and then sold them as the legitimate goods with a product in there that wasn't even close to the real product. And those products, it was interesting. Those products were seized by U.S. Customs coming into the U.S. And the party that was there was a gray marketer, and they accused the brand of engaging in counterfeiting itself by allowing those bottles to be used by the destruction company and then the third party contractor to refill them and sell them back into the U.S. So these get very complicated and they're very expensive for the brands, you know, to try to police all that.
Well, and then, you know, and when you talk about the genuine packaging, that's another thing, because that's usually bearing the authentication marks, right? So right. A lot of the manufacturers are embedding the covert or overt authenticity marks on the packaging. So I can imagine. It's interesting point to the packaging and reuse the quality rejects or something that's not supposed to use. You have to be really careful as a manufacturer or brand owner. I had a similar case where I used to work for a solar company and the cells were making it to the black market. Quality rejects, they were broken, put in the drums. Guess what? The drums were showing up in Hong Kong. And they were so good that they actually took the broken pieces and cut them into small squares and make a solar panels from the small squares. We found out and we went to the recycling and destruction sites and all that stuff. And problem is that countries, let's say Philippines, Malaysia, or China, a lot of these recycling companies and shredding companies are actually run by triads. And therefore, you know, I think as a brand owner, you have to make sure if you're a third-party manufacturer or your own production, you should ensure that nothing leaves a factory that is ever potentially usable. So I think the solution for your example, Tony, would be just to have somebody hammer on site. Just break the glasses on site and then just...
A break-in room.
Yeah, that's what we were doing. I mean, we had a manufacturing in Mexico and we basically had people breaking the panels, make sure that they cannot leak. So because we were finding the panels that were non-functional being sold on the market on the brand. And that was really impacting our reputation. So, got to be careful. You have to know where you're working. I mean, in U.S., you can sort of rely on the shredding. You know, still have to monitor that and audit that. But when you go to different parts of the world, you have to be aware of the ecosystem and how it works there.
Yeah, so one of the ways of preventing is to make sure that whatever is in your factory, it gets destroyed properly and is unusable afterwards. And how did the perfume case end? Or it hasn't ended yet?
Well, no, it has ended. They found that the actual brand holder was not liable for the counterfeiting, and there were a lot of different reasons for that. But it was a jury trial. I mean, it was a jury trial, and the jury found that they were not liable for it, because it was hard to say that the actual brand holder was involved in the counterfeiting. It was really a contractual problem. It was a breach of contract, not so much a counterfeiting situation.
But it could have easily spun the other way and saying, if you didn't put enough prevention and control in place, you are really liable for that, because you could have just put some kind of controls in place that would prevent that, right? Now,
exactly.
would that be a case where it would be a consumer in, you know, it would be a risk to consumers?
That might happen.
We've seen
cases where the brand holders have gone after the distributors who contractually sometimes have responsibility for policing the markets, and they have found the distributors liable for counterfeiting, either contributory liability, usually contributory liability, for failing to police the marketplace under a distribution agreement. And so the brands do have the power to do that, but through contract. And so that's not unusual.
They were obligated through a contract, to make sure that in the market there was nothing going on that could affect the brand. So they were bound to check on competitors or other potential counterfeit, any other irregularities. And if they failed to do that, then they're liable because they're under a contract.
And somebody and a consumer had brought a case against the brand holder for the importation of counterfeits. I know in one case, it was a toy case where there was a big problem, a cross-border problem between Canada and the US with these particular toys. And the toy distributor in Canada was obligated to police the marketplace there so that this cross-border commerce wouldn't take place. And a consumer bought a counterfeit toy that was supposed to be distributed in Canada in the US. And that led to this lawsuit. And the brand sort of passed responsibility for the counterfeit sale onto the distributor in Canada,
You have to make sure that your contracts are up to this knot. So when you deal with distributor, you should always have a clause that they're only allowed to purchase from you or your authorized suppliers if it comes to the branded goods, right? So then you have to audit once a year, once in 2 years. You want to make sure that you're auditing what they buy and where they sell to. So it's like in this case, you have to make sure that this is a Canadian distributor sells in Canada. They shouldn't be shipping to US, right? And this is very common across the industry. And this is why you have to have a firm contracts and trust but verify. So you have to do the audits for sure.
You are listening to Intangiblia, the podcast of intangible law, plain talk about intellectual property.
Yeah, it's not only having the contract written down and sealed, but you also have to make sure that it's being respected. So you have to do the auditing, you have to go to the market and make some verifications by yourself as a brand owner.
It is. And, it gets more complicated when you talk to when you go to companies that deal with a highly sensitive intellectual property, the patents and technology and trade secrets, especially now with the outsourcing, you have to make sure that your contract with your, third party manufacturer or up to snot, you have to make sure that you have nailed down to destruction of the quality rejects and junk. You have to make sure that nobody other than a required and limited personnel has access to the technical literature, design, whatever, right? So this is all the areas you have to make sure because if you don't do so, we've seen so many cases when companies, high-tech companies, had a manufacturing and they had employees and they trained them and an employee opened a shop next door. Okay.
Oh, wow.
And was doing exactly product. and even worse examples are some of these products actually made on a proprietary machinery. And when the machinery is actually obsolete, supposed to be junked or what have you. No surprise, those machine ends up the next door and they continue to make the product for years after. It's happening all the time.
So they take the machine that doesn't work anymore, or it was exchanged for something better, and then they take it and they keep on going right next door without any.
it is, and you know, like you have to understand, when you're a third party manufacturer, you only get paid by the brand owner for finished goods. Any quality rejects, anything that is junked, they're not compensated on. So they're basically liable for the goods. So this motivates them to do better quality. But nevertheless, if somebody comes to you and say, hey, I'll pay you for this junk, I'll take it off your hands. Some of them will do that just to recover some of the cost. Obviously, they're not allowed to do so if your contracts are, you know, written properly, but happens all the time. And same thing goes with the manufacturing, the machinery, right? If you have a proprietary machine that makes typical casting, whatever, for the watch, for example, and then, you know, that model is obsolete and it cannot be used, and then they try to get rid of it, they depreciate it, whatever. Well, somebody comes and offer you money for that. Some of these less scrupulous people or businesses just see that as an opportunity and will sell the machine. That's why it's important for brand owners to monitor, control, be basically involved, have maybe people on staff at the facilities, have, you know, oversee the destruction, oversee dismantling of the production and all that stuff. Can't just rely really on anybody.
So keep an eye on your things.
Trust but verify. You know, you may have a good partner, but money talks. And if it's a large opportunity for somebody, they'll, you know, maybe sway. And don't get me wrong, sometimes it's not a company, sometimes it's a rogue employees. There's a lot of examples where sales guys, distributor sales guys make arrangement with the company, convince them to buy high volume, provides them a discount, and then the company dumps it on the gray market, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then they, you know, obviously get compensated under the table. So it happens. That's why you have to be careful about, you know, who you're hiring. You have to oversee, you know, what people are doing. Make sure that you compensate them on the proper things, not just the volume of sale, because that sometimes leads to the wrong decisions. People are spying more and more. This is, you know, the cybersecurity increased 51% in supply chain. The breaches of cybersecurity in 2021 was increased by 51% of supply chain. That's considering that, you know, the pandemic and all the shortages are causing. Actually, interestingly enough, for the counterfeiting and gray market, the shortage of semiconductors and raw supplies, because of this, supply chain was disrupted, significantly increased. And actually, I'm witnessing quite a bit of counterfeiting on a semiconductor. And what I mean by that is people taking all chips out of the boards. And this was an article that was like 10 years back, but it's coming back again, where people were melting the boards, taking the chips out, repolishing them, reprinting them, and selling them again as a brand new chips. So the shortage of semiconductors actually increased the occurrence of the counterfeiting, even in the semiconductor industry. And that can go to selling the older version of the chips as a brand new one and just change the firmware on it, or take something that was previously used and, you know, soldered, take it out, clean it up, clean the leads, reprint it, and resell it again. That's certainly resurfacing more and more still.
And Peter, this is so common for all brand holders, where they drive up demand and they can't fill the demand. I mean, even in a non-supply chain, crisis like we had during the pandemic, you see companies that, you know, it's where the, and I think the book sort of addresses that. It's the problem of silos within these companies where one area doesn't understand its impact on another area and how they are all, you know, in one sort of environment, you know, in one sort of space. And so you have the demand buildup, but you can't fill it. And that's where the counterfeits come, you know, rolling in to feed that demand.
Yeah, actually, it comes even, it ventures into enterprise risk management area where you should be having the backup plan and don't put all the eggs in one basket because, you know, disruption of supply chain and a lot of companies that did not have that backup and did not have option of multiple suppliers actually paid a high price and they couldn't deliver. So obviously, they were also suspect of potential counterfeiting and gray marketing and what have you. Certainly, that's the risk factor that plays in with the wrong planning and forecasting as well. Yeah.
So it's a multi-factor problem, and it has quite a lot of reasons, causes, and also it's not only on the person trying to get a profit, but also it can be triggered by the trademark owner itself, if it's not careful enough in the market.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it is a complex topic.
Yes, of course.
That's why it needs two volumes.
Exactly. So what would you be recommending to the trademark owners? How can they prevent this from happening? How can they protect themselves? How do they protect their trademarks in the market and in a way that it can, we know that it's not going to be 100% protection, but at least the best protection that they can find.
My views have changed on this quite a bit over several decades. I think that we do have the ability to control to a certain extent the levels of counterfeiting within given industries. And obviously, there are all sorts of forces at play in this space that impact the amounts of counterfeiting and who's engaged in it. I think most recently, I would say that the financial area is a very interesting and I think a potentially ripe area to try to control it by cutting off the profit or the revenue stream to the counterfeiter, making it less profitable, interrupting the financial transactions. But we have to recognize that in certain parts of the world, the financial transactions are literally, you know, handing someone a piece of paper that has an IOU on it. You know, it's not through a banking system. It's much more, I would say, organic in terms of how it works. On the other hand, now we have cryptocurrency, which concerns me quite a bit because of the ability to use that and not have the ability to interfere in those transactions and to even know what, you know, the sources and what's going on there. Those operators engaged in counterfeiting. I think, as Peter pointed out, you really do need to have a good assessment of what your sort of objectives are, what your business means in terms of the marketplace. And if you're a pharmaceutical company, you probably will have a different anti-counterfeiting program or effort of, you know, that's different than a popular, you know, concert touring rock band that sells t-shirts and, you know, caps at concerts. So obviously each trademark owner has to make an assessment of what their IP portfolio, their protection is, and then how it might be endangered along the way, and then the methods available to try to control it. I think it is important that trademark owners that are doing commerce, either domestically or internationally, register their intellectual property, whether it's patents, copyrights, registrations, because in order to enlist the assistance of government agencies that can often be your, you know, best source of enforcement, you have to have these things registered pretty much. And then third, I would say that, you know, consumers have got to play a role. You've got to do something about the demand. And, you know, the most recent studies are a little disheartening for those of us who've been fighting counterfeiting for so many decades, because it shows that people only are primarily concerned about counterfeiting when it comes to their personal health and safety. And that, to me, you know, says that brand owners haven't done a good enough job in sort of making efforts to, you know, control counterfeiting more acceptable among, you know, the various consumer populations. It's not okay, you know, consumers don't understand that maybe by purchasing counterfeit goods, they're enabling other types of antisocial behavior, corruption, other things to take place, because it's an easy source of cash, money. It's an easy way to launder money. And I think that we haven't done, as a community of brand and rights holders, done a very good job of educating consumers that this is a problem that should be at least considered when they're making those decisions. The studies show that people know they're buying counterfeits in many, many cases, you know. And what's even more surprising is that younger consumers who like to talk about sustainability and transparency, they tend to be the ones who are buying more of the counterfeits. And so there's a little hypocrisy in that, you know, situation, you know. And I think really it goes back to the rights holder community not doing a good enough job, not spending the resources on that type of, you know, education. In some countries, it's much better than others. I find in Europe, France, other countries, UK, there's a much greater effort at that type of, you know, public education.
Yeah, so it's not that I bought this item and that's it. I mean, I bought it counterfeit because it's a good price, it's a bargain, and it's something that I'm saving hundreds of dollars or whatever, pounds or euros, right?
Yeah.
It's not that. It's there's a whole network behind. There's a whole life ecosystem world behind this counterfeiting, and how that got into your hands, it has a trail, and yes, that trail is usually dirty.
Often. I mean, sometimes it is the, you know, the bottles that should have been destroyed, you know, that sort of thing. But there were still people who, you know, were trying to use that to make a profit. And you know, let's be frank, it's people want bargains, or they're aspiring to own merchandise that they can't afford. And that's in the technology area as well. You know, you get a better price on technology or electronic goods, things like that. And now we have this, there's an interesting area that we haven't touched on, is the recycling area and the upcycling area. And that was a particular area of interest for me, because we see this sort of interaction between the desire for sustainability and transparency, and also the misuse of trademarked goods, you know, whether it's a watch where they, you know, as Peter pointed out before, you might get a combination, someone may replace parts with a non-authorized good and still claim it's, you know, a certain branded product. There have been, you know, court cases regarding that. It might be, I see now that people are taking things like Bic cigarette lighters that cost 52 cents, and they're wrapping them in the skins of Gucci or LV, you know, handbags, and charging $700 for them on the internet. And that's the sort of thing that I find, you know, yeah, they're recycling maybe. They might be using counterfeit skins, which is likely. And, you know, that sort of thing's going on. Or, you know, cutting up old handbags. I saw a T-shirt where someone had taken an Hermes scarf and just cut the Hermes logo and applied it to the front of the T-shirt as a pocket, you know? And they were charging now, I think, $500 or $600 for like a $20 T-shirt, that sort of thing. And that, yeah, to me is just, you know, it's, I don't know, if someone's going to buy it, I guess, fine. And the other area now are the NFTs, the non-fungible tokens. And that's a very interesting area because in this one case, again, Hermes, where a designer has created these handbags that he's recreated the handbag. I guess it's the Birkin bag, and surrounded it with fur or something, you know, changed the outer appearance slightly, but still promotes it as a Birkin bag, you know. And these NFTs are going to be, that's going to be a very interesting area as to whether those are going to be considered counterfeit goods or not.
Or design.
Is it art as well? So we have...
Peter? Not just the bags, but, you know, we have dresses, right? And that's been around too. Like people take the fashion show and basically reverse engineering dresses and post them on the websites and basically sell the design. So NFT is going to introduce more complication to it. But you know what? I think we're going in a cycle of this because we can go back to DMCA and, you know, the Napsters and whatever. That sort of faded away. I think the affordability of the music and movies kind of got a little bit more accepted. So, but I have to admit, when, you know, back, I was downloading music for free and not intentionally avoiding any charges, but it was available. These days it's getting a little bit more difficult. And I think Apple Store, iTunes, and, you know, Google Store make it somewhat accessible and affordable. So I think that may be a way to go about these topics. But certainly bootlegging is still available. A lot of criminal organizations, including terrorist organizations, actually, this is the much easier source of money for them to do counterfeiting than do the drugs and opioids. And it's actually less prosecuted. So if they get caught, they're really not being charged as much as if they were caught with a bag of drugs, right? So that's certainly an area that is of interest to certain elements. Education has always been there. I mean, as Tony mentioned, those examples where somebody's making the counterfeit T-shirt using, and that was, I assume that sort of boundary between secondary good and counterfeit and authentic good, because it was like mix of everything. But they price it at the level that you believe that you might buy genuine goods. Whereas, exactly, as you know, when you, you know, and you're buying Gucci bag for $5, you know it's a counterfeit. Okay. You just do it. There's no way around it. So as Tony mentioned, it's, you know, you're probably more concerned about the fact that you're buying something that, you know, you wouldn't buy drugs or medicines did you know they're counterfeit voluntarily for your own consumption? I mean, there are people that buying it and distribute it to somebody else. Those are the unscrupulous people. But same thing. People don't actually realize, and I think this is what I would support Tony and the educational perspective, is that fashion industry is one of the most polluting industries in the world. Shoes and clothing. I don't know if you know statistics. We overproduce so much shoes, so many shoes and so much clothing. It's actually only 20 or 30% of the clothing that is ever manufactured sold. Rest of it is junk, destroyed. This is a huge impact environmentally. And people don't realize that. But I mean, counterfeits, same thing. It's just contributing to pollution big time. And trust me, if Louis Vuitton is making something, they probably have a much better control of the environmental and how it's used and what kind of chemicals and how they're disposed, as opposed to these counterfeiters that don't give a damn pretty much about the environment. They're just into it for a short period of money, quick earning, and move on. So I think maybe this is an aspect that needs to be put more in education, especially to the younger audience. If they're so cautious, and the young generation is cautious, and I don't know if they're hypocrites or not, but certainly level of purchasing power plays into it. And I don't want to go into different societal discussion here, but I think our society needs a major shift into distribution of the wealth, because everything starts with the economy. If people are in poverty, they just have no choice. And, you know, while 1% of the population owns 99% of the wealth, it's just not right. And this is what's driving everything. Underappreciations of stay-home moms, they're not being compensated, they have not been recognized, their purchasing power completely depends on the other incomes. So, I mean, that economical stuff has to change as well, which I believe may also impact the demand for the counterfeits. Because if you're you know, living level of, what do you call it, living expenses and all that stuff goes up, then you can certainly afford to buy something more cautiously and be more concerned about environment, all that stuff, whereas you're basically in survival mode, right? So all that has to come together, and hopefully it will.
So it's one premise, protecting the brand, two volumes. So the first volume is counterfeiting and gray markets, and the second is boosting the bootlegs. Yes, I mean, if something final that you would like to tell us.
To the readers and to the listeners, if you're interested and as excited about these issues and subject as Tony and I and Letizia, so just go and read it. First volume is geared towards the executive and practitioners. It's more broad. Second volume is more focused on U.S. statutes and the legal ecosystem around it. But they go together. It was just too much to publish as one volume. So that was the main reason we published in two volumes. But go and read. You can always follow up if you have any questions, and we'll more than happy speak on the topic to you and your companies anytime.
I would just say that despite the complicated nature of maybe what we presented today, hopefully that the emphasis on sort of unsiloing the activities within brand holder companies, being vigilant in as Peter says, verify, trust but verify in terms of your partners in business, and giving the up and coming consumers a better sort of understanding of why people are concerned about counterfeiting, and that there are things that can be done that will benefit the environment, will benefit people's well-being, safety. These are things that are achievable. And it really just takes some focus among all the other things that are going on in one's, you know, one's world these days. So I remain optimistic that things can be done.
Well, thank you so much, Peter and Tony. Thank you for your time, for sharing your knowledge with us. And hopefully we will see each other again, maybe in a third volume of the book. And yes, thank you for your time, and thank you for everything.
Awesome. Thank you.
I'm good too.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank
Always
you,
Tony. A pleasure.
Thank you, Peter. And have a good day and good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
We have reached the end of our episode. Greetings from Switzerland.
Thank you for listening to Intangiblia, the podcast of intangible law, plain talk about intellectual property. Did you like what we talked today? Please share with your network. Do you want to learn more about intellectual property? Subscribe now on your favorite podcast player. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Visit our website www.intangiblia.com. Copyright Leticia Caminero 2020. All rights reserved. This podcast is provided for information purposes only.